What's up, sports fans? What's up, gamers? Welcome to episode 5 of the FIFA series and the second part of our episode, Desert Heat. If today's the first day that you found us, welcome to the Offside family. We're so glad you found us. That said, if you haven't listened to any of our other episodes, I'm going to strongly suggest that you go back and listen to the other FIFA episodes in order before you listen to this one, particularly because this is a part two. This story pretty much has to be told in a particular order, and it makes a lot more sense if you listen to it in that order. Want to listen in a completely flipped order? Go for it! I won't stop you! Before we go any further, though, I want to dedicate today's episode to a very important person in my life, my best friend, Taz. Taz and I started our podcasting journey together during quarantine in 2020. The topic of the podcast that we were working on then is totally different from this one, but Taz and I had so much fun making it together that I was absolutely hooked. This podcast is a direct result of that one. It's pretty safe to say that this podcast wouldn't exist without Taz and the work that we did on that first one. For the first podcast Taz and I worked on together, we promised ourselves that we would celebrate our victories in increments of 5 to keep ourselves going. So, considering this is episode number 5 of the FIFA series, I wanted to dedicate this to her. This podcast is for you, Taz. Thanks for all that you do and did and continue to do in always making me laugh at literally almost anything. I love you, dude. I hope you enjoy this one. Welcome to episode 5 of the FIFA series, dudes. Let's go! Offside! If you've been here a while, you know what time it is. It's that part of the pod where I let you know that this podcast is likely to contain some less than perfect language. I get pretty jacked up and excited when I do this podcast, so my language isn't always ideal. That said, this is a podcast about sports and games. So, I wanted you to be able to listen to this whole podcast with whoever you wanted. So I'm going to beep the audio. I think this sound, though, is super boring. I'm always going to beep the audio using other sounds. Each of these sounds will somehow relate to the episode that you're listening to. If you want to hear how the sounds are related in the last episode, or related to each other, then you can do that by listening to the middle intermission section of this podcast. And you'll hear the answers for this one in the middle section of the next FIFA episode. I marked that middle section with this whistle sound. All right, that's pretty much how this podcast works. Ready? Let's go! Just kidding, kids. I couldn't possibly move forward without a bit of a recap. Just an editor's note here that I know that the audio in the last episode was a bit whack. I'm still out here learning how to perfect audio quality. But if you want to hear the whole thing a little easier, I'm going to post a link to where my podcast is actually hosted outside of Spotify and iTunes. For some reason, the quality seems a little bit better there. All right, back to your regularly scheduled program. I don't want to take too much more of your time. All I'm going to say is this. Our man, Mohammed bin Salman from the last episode, Mr. President of the Asian Football Confederation, he's in some trouble. And when goes down at FIFA, the place that runs one of the largest tournaments in the world for one of the world's most favorite games, the whole world listens, no matter if you want them to or not. So, as per my brother's suggestion would indicate, seriously, thanks for that suggestion, little brother. I mean it. I didn't give you much of a recap this time. Unfortunately for both him and me, though, the nature of this episode kind of demands it, especially since I sort of messed up the audio in the last one. That's also in part because there's approximately 17 minutes of the last podcast that you didn't really hear from last time. Why do I know that was 17 minutes you missed? Well, because I timed it, folks. And like I said last episode, if I'd put it in last episode, you would have had to listen to me for well over an hour. And I didn't want to do that to you. Therefore, the next section you're getting is based on the 17 minutes that you missed from last time. So, Like I said from the recap, when we left Mohammed bin Hammam, president of the AFC, that's the Asian Football Federation, not KFC, that is indeed a chicken restaurant, had been caught allegedly bribing attendees to a CONCACAF conference that he called in the Port of Prince in Trinidad, along with then CONCACAF president Jack Warner. In his upcoming bid to challenge the then president and wannabe mob boss of FIFA, President Joseph Sepp Blatter, in FIFA's presidential election in 2011. This being after President Blatter had served as FIFA's president for a whopping 13 years. In part of the pitch that he made both to the global FIFA members and the global media, FIFA said this to The Guardian's Owen Gibson way back in 2011. At the end of the day, we're an organization that belongs to the public. It doesn't belong to us. We have to make ourselves very clear to people. This is one of my missions for the future. He went on to say that, quote, "I think I can rehabilitate FIFA's reputation." But what happens to a guy who says that? Who says that he, quote, "thinks he can rehabilitate FIFA's reputation"? What happens to a guy who says this about his desire for a potential FIFA presidency and then gets caught bribing people like he did in the last episode? I'm so glad you asked this. Well, Mohammed's reaction to these bribes from the top FIFA brass was nothing if not swift. Again, according to the incredible work of our friend Ken Binsinger in his book Red Card, this is what happens. Some of the attendees at Bin Hammam and Jack Warner's conference in the Port of Spain were so shocked by what seemed like blatant bribes. Also, some of them had very reasonable questions outside of what's the deal with the bribes? The most pressing of these being, can they take these bribes? And if they did, how on earth were they supposed to take the $300,000 cash in these envelopes across the borders of their various home nations? Upon hearing about the news about how Jack Warner had suggested that Mohammed had given credit to providing cash gifts to the member nations at the Port of Spain conference to the Caribbean Football Union, also known as the CFU, so that they were not perceived on behalf of Bin Hammam, Jack Warner's secretary and second member of the Bromance from Hell in FIFA episode 2 of this podcast, and then secretary to both CONCACAF and Jack Warner, Chuck Blazer, was incredibly angry at Jack's insistence that they were taking credit for Bin Hammam's very obvious bribes. This is, of course, not only a blatant violation of FIFA's ethics, but also, in this podcaster's mind, probably an attempt for Jack Warner to establish himself as close to someone who might become FIFA's next president. Again, according to Ken Binsinger's book, Chuck is rumored to have said something to the effect of, quote, "In 21 years, we've never bought a vote. We have had elections and been in office all that time and have never bought a vote. Now you've allowed this to happen here? It completely changes the entire dynamic of the Confederation." Close quote. Do we believe that neither of these men had accepted bribes over the course of 21 years of their FIFA career? I don't know. I'm not here to make that judgment either way. But what does an angry Chuck Blazer do when he hears of the transgressions of his boss? Well, he tattles, of course. After consulting longtime FIFA legal advisor, yes, that's a real job apparently, John Collins, Chuck went to Jerome Bielecki, who was the general secretary to FIFA as a whole, and who was initially touted by then FIFA president Sepp Blatter as someone who was going to help FIFA clean up their slightly shady image at the time. As soon as Bielecki heard about what had gone on in the Port of Spain with the seeming bribes, he instructed Chuck Blazer to prepare a report of what had gone on, present to the big brass in FIFA prior to their presidential election that was happening in May. After hearing from Chuck, General Secretary Bielecki got in touch with John Collins, Chuck's lawyer, who put together the report by interviewing several of the folks who were present at the conference and preparing to report what they presented to FIFA on May 24th, 2011, according to Ken Binsinger. The conclusion of this report was that, in fact, the bribes had been handed out by Jack Warner and his team at the behest of the president of the Asian Football Confederation in the service of buying votes for Mohammed bin Hammam for the upcoming FIFA presidential election. Just a day after they received the report from Collins, in the interest of what they then called, quote, full transparency, the upper brass of FIFA released the news of the report just a day after it had been submitted on May 25th, 2011. For those of you into foreshadowing, that is how FIFA first caught on to
The FBI's radar.
Turns out, even super cool spying federal agents watch the news. Based on the allegations of things that happened at the Port of Spain, FIFA's ethics committee called an emergency meeting that Sunday, May 29th, where something pretty predictable happened if you know anything about any of these bigwig FIFA guys. Just before the hearing began, Bin Hammam resigned not only from the FIFA presidential run, which left incumbent President Joseph Sepp Blatter as the only option for the upcoming vote, but also from the organization of FIFA for itself.
Well, Bin Hammam withdrew from the organization.
He did pledge that he would attend the ethics meeting and accept his punishment, though I'm not sure he knew 100% what was coming for him. Jack Warner, for his part, did what I think, having researched him as much as I have, was for his part a very, very Jack Warner thing to do. He completely denied wrongdoing on his own part, and he countered the ethics committee's accusation of his own wrongdoing by submitting an ethics complaint of his own against then President Joseph Sepp Blatter. He claimed that Sepp had also approached Jack with a similar offer of bribery money for his own vote earlier in the year. Basically, Jack Warner took to these allegations the same way that my little brothers and I used to when we were little. He claimed he didn't do anything, and then he pointed the finger at somebody else. Nonetheless, here's what the ethics committee decided. Basically, as was quoted by FIFA's press guy at the time, there was a possibility that, quote, possible acts of corruption had been committed, and that as a result, both Jack Warner and Bin Hammam were, quote, provisionally suspended from all soccer-related activities until final decisions were made in terms of a more permanent punishment. In the case of Sepp Blatter, since the committee could find no evidence, since they were relying on then Jack Warner's word alone, Sepp Blatter was cleared of any wrongdoing. I'm going to leave the specifics of what each man is said to have testified to the ethics committee, to the fine work of Ken Bensinger and his book Red Card. You can look it up. I'm sure it's very Googleable at this point. Basically, though, this is what the final results of that ethics committee and their decision for punishments for each man were. Before a final verdict could actually be made with regard to punishment, Jack Warner actually chose to resign as the president of CONCACAF and retire from FIFA as a whole entirely. In a decision that this podcaster will not understand for the life of me, this resignation caused FIFA to tell the press that Jack Warner would leave with the presumption of innocence.
Oh.
For his part, Bin Hammam was suspended from FIFA and international soccer indefinitely and forever. Despite all of this, FIFA elections for president went off without a hitch just 4 days later, and as expected, Sepp Blatter was elected FIFA president for his fourth consecutive term. As a final farewell to these two men in FIFA, I want to leave you with two very different quotes from these men upon hearing their fates from the committee. For his part, Jack said this to the waiting press, quote, "I am in FIFA for 29 consecutive years. I was the first black man to have ever been in FIFA at this level. I have come from the smallest country ever to be on FIFA's executive committee. I am wielding more power in FIFA now than sometimes even the president. I must be the envy of others." Close quote. In one final act of what I will call foreshadowing, Jack said this, "I will tell you something. In the next couple of days, you will see a football tsunami that will hit FIFA and the world." For his part, Mohammed bin Hammam was a little bit more chill, at least to the press, about it, saying this, quote, "There is nothing that I can say more other than to deny the allegations and insist that I have done anything wrong during this special conference at Trinidad," according to The Guardian. And Netflix FIFA undercover documentary state that it has been heard from sources that Ben Halman felt that the decision to have him ousted from FIFA indefinitely was actually a racist decision. Does this mean that this is the end of Ben Halman from the story? Definitely not. But I'm tired of talking about sad, power-hungry rich dudes, aren't you? I think it's time for intermission. What's up, sports fans? What's up, gamers? If you heard that whistle sound, congratulations. That means that you've reached the approximate halfway point of this podcast. It also means that you've reached the part of the pod where I'm not only going to provide you with some random facts I found while researching this episode, it's also the part of the episode where I give you the answer to what the mystery sounds were for last episode. If you want to know what the mystery sounds were for this episode, you'll have to listen to this section in our next FIFA episode, in our next episode's intermission. All right, with that out of the way, let's get right to it. Since we spent last episode's intermission teaching you about remote control camel racing, yes, that's a real thing, the censorship sound I used was, in fact, the sound of a camel, like this. All right, with that out of the way, I think it's time for some random facts. Since I just taught you about the very real job of John Collins being a lawyer who specializes in sports law, I thought it might be cool to teach you about some of the other cool jobs in sports that you might not have known about, or that seem like weird, real jobs. Ready for that? Let's do it. And just in case you want to be a real square and skip this section entirely, I'm going to let you do that with a timestamp that I'm going to leave right here.
21:51.
When this intermission is over, we'll bring you back into the story about Mohammed and Jack. But random job number one, now that we've sorted that away. Referee. Okay, so I know this might sound like a really obvious choice for a sports job. However, if you think about it in terms of what an actual job is like, it's kind of weird if you think about it. Think about it. You're wearing aggressive black and white stripes with a whistle and have a grasping of a rule book of your company that goes far beyond anyone else in the place. Not only is this person present to enforce the rules, but he's also available to break up fist fights when they occur and occasionally take an arid fist to the face.
Ooh.
Oh yeah, and regardless of the outcome, no one ever actually likes or thanks you. In the NHL, according to the folks at boardroom.com, those who choose to don the stripes make around $220,602 in their first year, and up to $482,226 thereafter. Linesmen in the NHL, which also wear orange stripes, make around $141,000 and $270,000 with experience. The average NHL season is around 82 games, and according to their bargaining agreement, refs are expected to officiate between 73 and 82 regular season games, and only 20 referees are chosen to officiate the playoffs. Is that enough money to risk being cursed at and unintentionally punched in the face? That's for you to decide, I guess. Weird job number two, goal judge. Again, this might seem really obvious, but one of my favorite things about this job is some of the terminology that comes with it. In the case of the NHL, the ultimate goal judges, i.e. the ones who are not actually physically present at the arenas where the games take place, these guys work in a place in Toronto that the NHL calls the War Room. What goes on in the War Room? It's basically a room full of screens where judges can get every conceivable angle on a play. Not only do these guys weigh in on goals, but also offsides, and sometimes even the severity of penalties depending on how hits go down. Just like the NHL, NFL, and MLB umps and referees, these guys are seldom thanked or appreciated by any team. Unless, of course, the call goes in their favor. Weird job number three. Now, this job was a little harder for me to find a bunch of info on, largely because it's a relatively new job for most major sports organizations, but this is exactly what it sounds like. Concussion spotters are meant to be impartial judges who watch NHL or NFL games and look out for players for plays where players hit their heads. If spotters notice a hit that might look like someone hit their head too hard, and they believe they're at risk for a concussion, that a concussion may be afoot, they call down to coaches or referees and mandate that the player in question is checked by training staff for a concussion before they're allowed to play further. As you may or may not know, a concussion spotter's job in sports has largely become a thing in response to the uprising of knowledge about the dangers of repeated blows to the head and how little pro sports leagues were doing in order to protect their athletes. Just like most of the jobs on this list, concussion spotters, thankless job. Here on this podcast, though, we love a good concussion spotter. Thanks for all that you do, folks. Keep at it. All right. That, my friends, is the end of intermission. Let's get back to the main story, shall we? And welcome back to those of you who skipped on us. So I would be remiss if I didn't say we're getting close to the end of this cluster. That said, just because we're getting close to the end of the story doesn't mean that there's any lack of action. So just to keep you up to date, two major members of FIFA's Exco Committee, in both Jack Warner, president of CONCACAF, and Mohammed bin Salman, president of AFC, have been ousted from FIFA for being caught trying to buy votes for the upcoming FIFA presidential election. Incumbent president of FIFA Joseph Sepp Blatter was also accused of buying votes for the same presidential election by none other than the aforementioned Jack Warner. Those final accusations against Sepp Blatter were, quote, proven to be unfounded. From there, Sepp won an uncontested election for FIFA president. Got it all caught up? It might seem like that the catching of two Exco members for suspected corruption might spell the end of this story, but that's so far from the truth. Upon Jack Warner being ousted as president of CONCACAF, the initial whistleblower, Chuck Blazer, was initially touted as a bit of a hero for helping FIFA clean up some of its corruption, a role I'm quite certain the self-important Chuck Blazer enjoyed thoroughly. Again, the following is an act of foreshadowing. That victory lap for our guy Chuck Blazer was very short-lived, however. Not long after his boss Jack Warner was fired from his job, the man who took over the CONCACAF temporarily went by the name of Leslie Austin. Yes, his name really is Leslie, I checked. And who had previously been president of the Barbados Football Association, tried to almost immediately fire Chuck Blazer from his position as General Secretary of CONCACAF. This was met with not only a big push from some of Chuck's allies in other member nations with FIFA, but also it was a violation of FIFA's rule, as the firing of a General Secretary for an entire block of nations like Chuck requires the majority support from its member nations, something which Leslie Austin did not have. So for the meantime, at least, that means that Chuck Blazer is safe in his job at General Secretary of CONCACAF, which is a good thing, because Chuck, believe it or not, is about to become that much more important to the unwinding of this FIFA story. Want to know more? I bet you do. But that part of the story is going to take an entire episode to tell you. So in the meantime, I'm going to take what I'm sure will seem to you like a hard left turn. I promise it'll make sense in the fullness of time. Ready for that sharp turn? Let's go! I'm sure for some of you, it might be tempting to think of the grassroots of soccer in the United States as having started with something akin to the low-level soccer that your friend's kid engages in every Saturday. Though that might be tempting to think about, it's not entirely true. Let's rewind a bit, huh? According to the fine folks at worldsoccertalk.com, their links are in the show notes, this is how soccer and organized soccer in the US went down. The first soccer association in the United States to organize some sort of unifying cup for its members the American Football Confederation, or AFC. To use the rules put forth by the FA Association Football. Which aligned itself with other football-loving countries' associations, like the FA or the Football Association, which we learned all about way back in episode 1. This also means that the AFC chose
to use rules which
were first proposed by our friend Ebenezer Morley, again from episode 1.
Oh.
According to the fine folks at World Soccer Talk, the work of the American Football Association continued largely uninterrupted from 1885 to 1924. Some sources I saw showed the AFA ending much sooner, around the early 1900s. But I'm not here to heckle on the internet about 24 years. If you definitely know the answer and want to send me that email, my email's at the end of the pod. Anyway, one of the other problems, potential problems with the AFC, is that it contained mostly teams from the Northeast United States. Unfortunately for fans in the United States, however, one of the things that seems to have plagued high-level organized soccer is something I like to consider a bit of an American pastime, it seems. It's fighting about who's in charge. According to another one of my sources, the folks at usasoccerhistory.com, one of the other few major issues with the AFA were some of the follows. One, many folks in the league didn't like the idea that an American organization would align itself with the British Football Association. I'm sure I don't have to tell anyone who's been to a basic history class that America has nothing if not a slight disdain for Britain. Sorry for any British folks out there. Reason number two why it's stated that some folks in America wanted a different association from the American Football Association was that the organization had started to focus largely on the professional game. This left many amateur players with no place to organize. As such, in October of 1911, the organization known as the American Amateur Football Association, the AAFA, would create several football organizations within the United States for amateurs and grassroots soccer in America alike. The American Amateur Football Association would eventually morph into the United States Football Association, or the USFA, which is again the precursor to the U.S. soccer organization that we know now as the one that represents the United States in international competition today. The United States Football Association was granted membership into that infamous FIFA organization we all love so much in 1913. There's a little more history that I'm leaving out, but quite frankly, if I give you any more, we're going to run out of time. But as always, I'm going to leave you all my research in the description. So if you want to learn more, it'll be there. Why is the history of soccer in America so important, though? Again, I'm so glad when you guys ask me these questions. Well, the history of soccer in America is slightly more important because the folks who are about to help it hit the fan in this FIFA situation, well, it's about to come from one of the most unlikely nations in the world. at least when it comes to soccer. The final pin in this FIFA situation is about to come from America, the good old US of A. A country who, up until the recording of this podcast, has never won a World Cup and have only appeared in the tournament at all 11 times. That's at least when you're talking about men. The women's US team have done considerably better than their male counterparts. The women's side, since the women's FIFA organization started in 1991, which makes it not much older than this podcaster, for their part, the women's side has appeared in all 8 editions of the FIFA Women's World Cup and have won the World Cups and have won World Cup soccer supremacy 4 times, according to the International Olympic Committee. Up until fairly recently, though, the women's side, despite being more successful than the men, had received decidedly less funding. That said, this isn't a podcast about the gender pay gap in sports. That's for another episode. I'm just giving you the numerical facts. Like I was saying before, though, this history of the US becoming involved in international soccer is important because it's the United States and their legal system which is about to put international soccer on notice. And they're going to do it in a way, too, that that's probably not what you'd expect. It's honestly probably one of the most American ways to bring down an organization that there is. Or maybe that there has ever been. That said, I'm going to have to brush up on my sports law before I tell you that story. That, and we've run out of time, folks. So that story's for another day. Thanks for listening. And remember, it doesn't matter if you're onside or offside, just as long as you're inside the line. Keep playing, folks. I'll see you next time. The Tuna Line Offside podcast is a Sound Shifter production, meaning it's written, edited, and researched by yours truly. Shout out to Alex Action of Pixabay.com for the intro and outro of this pod, and thanks again for joining me for the 5th episode of this series. It means the world to me if you still hung out with me for so long. Thanks again to my buddy Taz for always being my podcast buddy behind the scenes. I love you, dude. Lastly, if you think I went offside, or if you think I stayed onside, you can email me at offside.podcast12@gmail.com. See you next time, guys.